You're listening to Lost Voices, a podcast about demystifying archives and the South Asian experience in Canada. I'm Alicia. I'm a journalist and editor from Toronto. If you've been following along, I'd like to tell you, you've made it! You've made it to the end of our little series. In our previous episode, we talked about oral history and how librarians and people in the archiving world are finding innovative ways to preserve brown voices for generations to come. Working with the Gwillim Archive has made me rethink my relationship with history and storytelling in general. What does modern and compelling storytelling look like today for journalists? How do digital archives shape memory? And how does that change the way we engage with history? My philosophy as a journalist is pretty straightforward. We have the ability to give a voice to the voiceless, so people feel heard and less alone. If someone were to ask me, Alicia, what's your superpower? I would honestly say it's being a journalist. Working in the media industry has challenged me to think about uncomfortable truths and experiment with new storytelling platforms to reach readers around the world. In December 2021, the Canadian Association of Journalists conducted its first ever survey of race and media. 209 newsrooms across Canada submitted demographic data. The key finding? Racialized journalists are concentrated in part-time and internship roles. I don't think you can talk about race without talking about resilience. It's easy to think resilience means strength, but for many marginalized people, being labeled resilient has other implications. The focus on resilience and applauding people for being resilient glosses over the problems they face and makes it too easy for others to avoid looking for real solutions. As we've discussed throughout this podcast, women of color and BIPOC journalists in general shouldn't avoid talking about being brown, but how can we do this without the word resilience forming a dark word cloud over our heads? Sahaj Kohli beautifully articulates what I'm trying to say. You might remember her from the first episode. She's a mental health therapist in training and the founder of Brown Girl Therapy, which you can find on Instagram. It's the first and largest mental health community for children of immigrants. The work you do around grief and some of the writing you've done around grief, you mentioned, you know, we might grieve oral history, inaccessible generational stories, because if they haven't been passed down, personally, I feel a bit of an emptiness or sadness more because I've never been able to foster a relationship with my dad's side of the family because they're in India. That's where they've been forever. So my relationship with them is very surface level. It's whatever I see on social media and the WhatsApp sort of chain of texts that come every now and then during like certain holidays. But there's a huge disconnect, and it's something that it makes me feel really sad because I feel like that part of my family would really help me understand so much of who I am. But just because of distance, I've never been able to foster a meaningful relationship with them. And I don't know if I feel kind of like stuck, like, how do I really do that? I feel almost like it's too late. Maybe that's wrong, but it definitely is something that kind of troubles me.
That is a very common feeling. I want to validate that, you know, that is incredibly hard, but it is incredibly common, especially amongst children of immigrants living in the West. I relate to that wholeheartedly. I am the youngest in my family on both sides. I am the youngest on one side of my family, like the youngest cousin, and I am the youngest, close to the youngest cousin on the other side of my family. And because of that, my parents are also the oldest on both sides. They're the oldest sibling, and all of my grandparents have passed away. So my last grandparent passed away a couple of years ago, and I have been dealing with my own grief since that because I've realized how much and how many oral stories and unanswered questions are now just taken from me forever because I will not have those people in my lineage to be able to ask those questions to. And I wrote a paper about this in my grief counseling class in graduate school. So there's this disenfranchised grief. So disenfranchised grief is really just a hidden grief. It's this grief that isn't really understood or talked about or discussed or openly seen in society or in public. And so many children of immigrants feel this type of disenfranchised grief. It's very real to feel like you are floating and untethered to your own history. And this is because of a lack of access to maybe parents, to grandparents, to extended family, because of language barriers. Even when my dad's side, when my dad's mom was alive, I could barely have certain conversations with her because there was a very real language barrier. There's internalized shame. So I am now reconciling with this grief of what my internalized shame has taken from me. I'm in my early 30s, but for much of my adolescence and young adulthood, I turned my back on my culture. I turned my back on where I came from. I didn't have access to my extended family. I was the first in my family to be born in the West. I was navigating all of these different factors and impacts to who I am. And now, as an adult who is married and can, you know, potentially going to start a family in the future, I am reconciling with how much my internalized shame has taken from me and what that has looked like. And so these lack of tangible resources, again, due to colonization, due to erasure, due to the fact that so many of us have been taught not to write things down, to only pass things through oral storytelling, narrative storytelling, there's so much missing. And so there's so many of us, like you said, really trying to find those missing pieces. And if anyone's ever done a puzzle and you're missing like 3 to 5 pieces, it is the most frustrating thing to be like, when can this be completed? How do I actually complete this? It's a very unsettling feeling.
I think when I reflect on my identity and how much I've evolved in my 20s, the one thing that sticks out is resilience. I think, you know, growing up, I was told I had to work twice as hard to be taken seriously. I had to speak up in a room because, you know, I don't have blonde hair. And I think a lot of this parental advice I got was obviously a result of systemic oppression that surrounded me and that my parents saw and what they had to fight for. But I think there is something inherently problematic about having to be so resilient. What are your thoughts on being told we just have to keep going, we just have to push through? Because it's kind of exhausting for me to always be on and trying to prove to others that my opinion matters and that my story is worth telling.
Yeah, it is definitely problematic. It's so many of us, like you said, were taught these narratives, were told these narratives because our parents or our grandparents or our ancestors lived out these narratives because, like you said, of systemic oppression, structural systems that are in place that require resiliency amongst certain populations and marginalized folks. Pushing through, for so many of us, there's this narrative that pushing through actually makes us strong, actually makes us more productive, actually makes us more likable, capable, able, all of these things. And that's, again, going back to the systemic oppression and systems that are in place that feed those narratives. But we have to reframe that and understand that pushing through also takes a toll on our self-concept, on our self-worth, on our mental health. We're not meant as humans to constantly have to prove ourselves. You know, that's why this whole conversation, there's this aching for a sense of belonging, because when you find a sense of belonging, when you find a community that kind of looks like you, feels like you, people who relate to you, you start to feel this inner peace, this calmness. You allow yourself to be able to become still, to slow down, because you no longer feel the sense of urgency of needing to connect with other people, find other people who can relate to your experiences. So this idea of pushing through, of powering through, it erodes our own sense of self. You know, we start to create our self-concept around this idea of doing, 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 rather than just existing and being and living. And so that's why finding communities like you gives us permission to rest, and it builds our own self-worthiness as a human who just exists in many different spaces, even if we don't feel like we fully exist in one.
Yeah, I find this so deeply relatable because I think constantly since I finished undergrad, it has been sort of a rat race to make sure I always have a job. I'm always proving myself in my job, taking on new responsibilities, never taking a moment to just pause and putting more projects on myself so that I feel like I have to be this multi-hyphenate professional because I need to have multiple sources of income, because my parents need to feel like, well, we're very proud of our daughter because she does X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z, and it's constant. And I think a little bit of that is also self-imposed at this point, but it comes from this internalized place of like, I have to keep doing to prove myself. And so I guess my final question to you is, you know, one thing I love that you write about is, I think you might have written this on Twitter. I don't remember where you wrote it, but you wrote something along the lines of like, what if inexplicable pain and sorrow don't need to be loud to be believed? What does that even look like?
That's a very good question. I think we're all still trying to figure out what that looks like. In general, I think this looks like feeling like your truth matters and will be accepted without having to prove it. In the context of the way I wrote the statement was in the context of resiliency and talking about these systems that are built and stacked against people of color, BIPOC, marginalized communities. And so instead of something that I'm really sitting with and something I like to tell people to sit with, and this is what I work through with my own clients, is instead of, wow, I'm so resilient, or wow, that person is so resilient, we really have to think about people and the systems they live in. And it's really, why does that person constantly need to tap into resilience? Why do we feel like we constantly need to be strong? You know, softness and slowing down and rest, these are all strengths. These are all courageous and natural human states to live in. But so many of us are unable to reach those states because of the systems that we live in that are stacked against us. And so when I think about not needing to be loud to be believed, it means just having those spaces where we can be heard, where we can be accepted, where we can be believed in whatever our experiences are without having to prove them.
It's interesting you say, you know, we don't have to be loud to be believed. And I've often thought, did I choose the profession that I'm in? Because it is a profession where you have to use your voice quite literally like this, or sometimes it's, you know, the power of the written word. But I feel like part of me was like, I think I always need to prove something through communication in like a very public kind of way. And sometimes I'm like, maybe that this is partly why I chose to be a journalist. I don't know. But it's just interesting to think about.
I'm the same way, right? I worked in media for 7 years and then moved to mental health. But then moving to mental health also meant starting a large social media platform where I use my voice every day. And I often reconcile with where that comes from. I don't know how to live in silence and in quiet. For me, it very much is advocating for those who aren't comfortable advocating for themselves and sharing those stories that deserve to be told that aren't getting enough attention.
It's encouraging to know that Sahaj can speak up for those who don't have the power to speak up for their mental health. Similarly, in the world of archives, we need to investigate who has the power here and hold them accountable to using it. We can use the Gwilym Archive as a starting point for deeper reflection on how to bring more diverse voices into our interpretation of the past. Who are we choosing to deem which media and histories are valuable and worth preserving? How can I decolonize my own understanding of my heritage and the histories of my ancestors? Now, so much of how I've dissected this Gwilym archive has been informed by my work in journalism. It's allowed me to talk to other professionals in the South Asian diaspora about their experiences as women of color in Canadian media. They might never interact with the Gwilym Project, but talking to them about how they think about disseminating and sharing untapped voices can go a long way. It can help librarians and academics start to think about how to make other research that's gathering dust more accessible. So of course, I had to chat with Aarti Patel. She is the co-founder of Didihood. Didi means sister in Hindi. So Didihood is sisterhood, a collection of South Asian women in creative industries across Canada, spanning from the media to music, film, and visual arts. Aarti is also a senior producer for entertainment and education at the CBC. How do you think social media plays a role in our online identities? I think a lot of second-gen kids like us can struggle with being authentic. Like, what does that really mean? What are the optics of that? And I think personally, like, I try to make my brownness more visible because I've been seen as not brown enough in a lot of circles. And I think a lot of times I'm trying to prove to society that actually, no, I am Indian, I am brown. As I've gotten older and not so embarrassed or turned my back on parts of my identity, like I actually think I've grown a lot on that kind of front. I think I can thank social media for that. What is your opinion? Do you think social media is helping us or hindering us when it comes to how we want to be seen online?
I think it's a really interesting perspective when you're talking about identity specifically, because I think in my experience, a lot of the South Asianness was very hidden. And what's interesting is that on social media, it was the same. So I think for me, you know, growing up in a bit of a stricter household where parents, you know, didn't let me go to the club or drink or smoke or do any of these things, I would, you know, go clubbing, go out, but then not share that part of my life on social media. I think a big thing for me was drinking alcohol, which isn't like a religious thing for me right now. But at that time growing up, it was something that was seen as taboo. And I remember even, you know, being on Facebook back in the day and my friends would upload these videos from university partying. And I was like, hey, don't tag me, don't post me. And a lot of that had to do with how I felt I was seen in the larger community, especially being part of a religious community and having, you know, a mandir or temple community, that I always felt like people were watching or judging. And it's kind of this notion of that when you're a South Asian woman, you're always being watched. And social media really amplified that, because it wasn't just people that I knew or people in my circle. So much of that was just open. So when I was thinking about this, you know, I was thinking about being in university when I got Facebook and just like hiding everything from everybody, like literally blocking every single brown auntie that I knew or older cousin who wasn't cool in my eyes, or just blocking anyone and everyone so I could really preserve that identity for me. Because that's a lot of that struggle of figuring out who you are and, you know, what your brownness is and what you want to show the world and what you don't. But I think it's also blossomed into a really great thing now. I believe that we're part of a much larger South Asian community than we ever have been. And so much of that community has always been really focused on the villages that your parents grew up in, or the religion that your parents followed, or if for some people caste, or whatever that specific was from our parents, that has been the community that you grew up with. But I think Nidihood, or even just South Asian communities now, it's much larger. And now we're connecting with people on a very different level, especially when we're thinking about things like identity and struggling with identity, trying to balance who you are in a newsroom or, you know, outside of that, or dating or whatever it is. It's allowed, I think, that community to grow in a way that organically it may have not grown. So for me, it's interesting to see, because I think I always hid a lot of my identity to begin with. Now I'm like, okay, this is who I am. And I don't know what a stereotypical Gujarati person is anymore, because I have influences of all kinds of parts of my life now. But the social media aspect has allowed us to create a larger, more diverse community, even within being South Asian.
Outside of work, obviously, Didihood, I think, is an incredible network you and your co-founders have created. And I think for me personally, like, what I've really liked about Didihood is, like, it helped sort of break the stigma that, like, not all brown kids are doctors and lawyers and engineers. Like, they can be calligraphers and graphic designers and writers, and, you know, there's a lot of us out there who are doing that. And so it's nice to see that we all exist.
I think the biggest thing was, it's something that I never had. I graduated 10 years ago now, and the co-founders of Didihood, we all went to journalism school together in Toronto, which is a very diverse city. But then when we got into journalism, we realized the actuality of that was not reflected in our program, both for staff and for students. So for us, it was never something like, let's create this now to help us. Like, none of that. It was an idea that we sort of sat on for years and years and years. And when we had initially launched it, I think the biggest thing was, at that point, we were already working sort of in the industry, especially Nikki and I. We went to events, we went to conferences, we went to, you know, news events where we saw the same people over and over again, but there was just no interaction. And it's funny, because when I talk to, when I say older South Asian women, so the generation, you know, before me, the same feedback that I get about Didihood, because they love it. But the thing that they tell me the most is that when we were in this industry, it was all competition. There could only be one of us in a newsroom. We were all fighting for each other's jobs and fighting for content. And that doesn't exist anymore. And a lot of that has to do with social media. It's been able to kind of bridge that gap between helping each other rise in all of these different creative industries and networking and getting internships and spots and job openings and just helping the community. Because if this whole idea about community is community, what is community? It's about maintaining that community. So for us, the big question was, why aren't we all speaking to one another? And why is it so hard to break that barrier? We're not in competition. We're in newsrooms or studios now that have more than one South Asian person, sometimes, not always, but why is this still so hard? So I think a lot of that was getting rid of that wall and really going to the community and asking what they wanted. Before we launched Ladyhood, we actually spoke with, I want to say about 20 people who were all South Asian. And we asked them, if we make something like this, what is it that you want from this community? And that's when we got good feedback. And that's when we had to really change a lot of our, even our own scope of what Ladyhood was. And I think that's important, community building, because when you're building a community, you need to know what the community wants. Like, I can just sit here and say, yeah, networking is great. And, you know, all these needies have jobs now. But that's not the goal. The goal is to figure out what it is the community wants. And that's what we did. And I've been to events where people are like crying because they've never had anything like this. And that's really nice. That to me is the most fulfilling thing, because, you know, I always joke, like, the most I see South Asians in the same room is like a wedding.
Let's end the conversation with a statistic. But, you know, I was obviously looking up some StatsCan stuff. South Asians do account for about a quarter of Canada's people of color population. So that's like 5.6% of Canada's population. That's a significant number. So we're everywhere. But exactly, like, when you go to networking events or you are, you know, in a newsroom, in the last 10 years, it's definitely changed. But, you know, the generation above us, they were fighting to be that one woman of color in the newsroom, to get that story, to get that position. So obviously networking and this, like, sort of growing sense of solidarity has been so nice, even for me, because I'm a few years younger than you, and I definitely feel the effects of it myself. So I guess, sort of looking ahead, how can journalists who, you know, want to help move the needle forward, make sure that our communities are being reflected? What is the next step beyond having the conversations?
I think the biggest thing is seeing South Asians as members of every community. So I think for a lot of times when we're asking South Asians to speak on something, maybe it's about, you know, Jagmeet Singh's race and how that his religion is specific in elections or politics. Like, I think we need to just broaden this idea. And I speak about this because I worked in lifestyle most of my career, where it is very, very white. And when we're even talking about things like getting experts or covering a story, we don't even think about South Asians as experts. And that to me is the biggest thing, because South Asians, yes, they're everywhere. They are parenting experts. Yes, we know that there's South Asian doctors and lawyers out there, but, you know, there's South Asians who work in fitness. There's South Asians who are influencers. There's South Asians who work in tech. There's South Asians everywhere. So we need to just broaden this idea of, when we're talking to people, why are we speaking with them specifically, and not make it just because that they're South Asian. It's because they also have expertise in their industries. I think the other big thing is talking to the community. You know, so much, like, this example I love, and I always think about this example when I talk about being South Asian representation. There was a few years ago where there were a lot of drownings happening in Brampton. And most people know that Brampton has a very high South Asian population. And I remember going to this conference about BIPOC journalists and media organizations. So a lot of, like, old ethnic newspapers that existed years ago. And this story came up, and we were talking about how most mainstream, most large organizations covered this, like, what's happening in Brampton? Like, it's not safe. Da, 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 da. When, like, the one South Asian reporter who was there that day is like, because a lot of South Asians can't swim. And she brought that up, saying that the children who had drowned, or the people who had drowned, she had figured out that a lot of them weren't swimmers, and how a lot of them weren't exposed to swimming classes at whatever age. And again, not saying that not all South Asians can swim, because of course South Asians can swim, but it was like a key point that she figured out because she talked to the community. And that's when your news, you know, really adjusts to how that story is reflected. So sometimes, like, I always find, like, when we're talking to South Asians, it's always something very cultural, like, hey, oh, Eid's coming up, or this is coming up, and we need to talk to South Asians and see what they're celebrating this year. And that's fine. Like, I think having that normalized, like we normalize every holiday, is fine. But what are some other issues that in this community that are not being talked about? Because maybe it's about education. Maybe there's something there about, like, even in lifestyle journalism. I remember for years, you know, wedding season is huge in the lifestyle industry space, but there's very little coverage of like South Asian wedding industries. And to me, and may I don't know the stats, that to me is the most expensive and biggest wedding industry. Why don't we think about this when we're doing like roundups of gowns or dresses or venues? Like why, like we're not thought to think to be more inclusive. And it's not just South Asian, it's every other sort of culture out there. So you have to talk to the community, because whatever do you think, you know, whatever the journalist thinks that community is dealing with right now is probably different than what it is when we actually talk to them. And that's important. You need to know the population is there. We need to know what the issues are in this population. It goes beyond journalism. Like, I think that's really the business side to all of this, because so much of the wedding industry can be a whole other podcast. So much of that has been like commercialized and westernized that yes, you can't find a card. Indigo, go ahead and make all your money, because you probably will make money just selling things like that.
What I love about this example of a wedding card is that it's something that can be so easily overlooked, but it's another reminder that representation needs to trickle down to the small decisions we make in our day-to-day lives. And this extends beyond the retail industry. I see it often within my own industry, that the survival of being a brown journalist depends on your ability to be resilient. Sometimes that comes out by being the only brown person in the room. Other times it comes out when the majority of stories we're pitched ask us to speak from a place of struggle. We're never afforded the opportunity to just be brown and be a journalist. The craft of journalism and the study of history often go hand in hand. It kind of goes without saying. But as I've been making this podcast, I've encountered so many new ways South Asian history is being documented for the future. Scroll Global, a news outlet for Indians living abroad, reported on a delightful project from the South Asian American Digital Archive. The organization collected lockdown letters from Indians across the country at the height of the pandemic. The letters were addressed to their future selves. The plan was to send these letters back to them on their doorsteps a year from now as part of what they call Letters from Six, referring to the 6 feet distance we kept to prevent spreading COVID. Media folks, archivists, and museum professionals came together to document and share the lived experiences of the South Asian diaspora during the pandemic. Honestly, I wish I could read some of those letters. But the fact is, this letter project will help paint a portrait of what life in the pandemic was like for some South Asians across the country. Investigating the Gwilym Archive at McGill University has given me a lot of hope. The vastness of this archive has never really been examined through a South Asian lens until now. Most of the researchers and librarians I spoke to told me how much the Gwilym Project impacted their understanding of colonialism and the very Western approach that this body of work was built on. I've definitely gained a new appreciation for the nuance and complexity it takes to expand our conversations around the different communities within the South Asian diaspora. And I hope through listening, you have too. There are so many untold stories and lost voices that are waiting to be heard. We can't compress our histories into reductive packages. Besides, why would we want to? There are so many untold stories and lost voices that are waiting to be heard. Thanks for listening to Lost Voices, an untold story of the South Asian diaspora, a podcast by McGill University, hosted and written by me, Alicia, and produced in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Anna, Richard, Steph, Lauren, Arthi, Sahaj, Sophie, Maria, Kanika, and others.